Mr. Speaker, this will be a thorough process focused on one of the most significant issues of our time. An issue that people across the country clearly want us to address. None more so than the many families who are facing the brutal and cruel reality of the status quo. Today is the beginning, not the end of that process. But the debate can only continue if colleagues join me in the I Lobby today, and I wholeheartedly encourage them to do so. I beg to move that this bill be submitted.
The question is that the bill now be read a second time. Donny Kruger.
I think you indicated that I could speak for a little longer than 8 minutes. Thank you very much. I just don't want to have too much grumbling at the 8 minute moment. I'll take about 15 minutes with, and time for intervention. So may I start by paying tribute to the Honourable Lady for her very powerful speech and indeed for the way that she's led this campaign with great respect and sensitivity, and to use the contested words, with great dignity. And she and I knew each other before we were MPs, when we both worked in the charity sector, and I like and admire her greatly, and I know that we have more in common than might appear today. And Mr. Speaker, we all have this in common in this House. We all share a deep concern about the experience of people dying or fearing death, fearing pain and suffering. And I wear heavily on my conscience the people whose lives will be prolonged beyond their wishes if I get my way and this bill is defeated today. I will not disregard those people or minimise their anxiety. And we will hear those voices in today's debate. We've heard many of them already, spoken through honourable members in what I know will be very moving speeches. But Mr. Speaker, if I voted for this bill, I would have on my conscience many more people whose voices we cannot hear. The people who would be vulnerable in consequence of the huge changes that this bill would induce in our society and in the NHS. And my view is that if we get our broken palliative care system right and our wonderful hospices properly funded, we can do so much more for all the people that we'll hear about today, using modern pain relief and therapies to help everybody die with a minimum of suffering when the time comes. But we won't be able to do that if we introduce this new option. Instead, we will expose many more people to harm. Mr. Speaker, I want to go through the bill in a moment, but first a word about process in response to the point made by the Honourable Lady there. This bill is simply too big for the time that it's been given. And I implore Honourable Members not to hide behind the fiction that it can be amended substantially in committee and in its later stages. The remaining stages of a private member's bill are for minor tweaks, not the kind of wholesale restructuring that we will need if we're ever to make this bill safe. And so members who vote for the bill today must be prepared to see it become law largely unamended. And I suggest that if they do have any doubts, the only responsible choice is to vote no and let the advocates of assisted dying bring back a better bill at another time. Happy to give way.
I deeply appreciate the respectful way he's making the point today, but I stand here before him not sure how any colleague in this chamber cannot have doubts whichever way they're voting today. It feels to me that there are two necessary harms we are all forced to weigh up, and I'm deeply intrigued to hear if he is so certain that doubt should push people one way, why that is, when it is very clear there are many, many people who will continue to suffer unnecessarily if we reject this bill.
Well, I recognise there are very many doubts on each side, and I fully respect the arguments that have been made by the Honourable Lady. Of course, this is a finely balanced debate. The point about process, though, is this bill is too flawed. There's too much to do with it to address in the committee stage. And by all means, let's have this debate, but we should be having it before a bill of this magnitude is brought, and the process of the bill should be much more comprehensive. Let me give way to the Honourable Gentleman.
I'm grateful to the Honourable Gentleman for giving way. But contrary to what the media are saying, today's decision is not about bringing this matter into law. It's about allowing it to go to the next stage. And if people have got misgivings, surely rather than making the assumptions that he is now today, assuming that in fact it cannot be corrected or amended to make it palatable to people who we all have doubts, that surely today's vote is to simply say, let it go to the next stage. The final decision at third reading is the one that is the critical one to decide whether it goes to law or not.
I think I made the point that this bill is too comprehensive and there's too much in it to address in the process of a private member's bill. And if the honourable gentleman thinks there are serious concerns with this bill that he thinks he would not be prepared to see come into law, then he should not be supporting it today. But let me try and explain. Let me move on now to try and explain what the concerns with the bill are that I think are too comprehensive to be dealt with in any committee stage. Now, I recognise how hard the Honourable Lady has worked to try and ensure that it is safe, and I don't believe it is for these reasons. So let's start at the beginning. The process starts with a conversation between a patient and a medical practitioner, not a doctor necessarily, just a medic of some sort, unspecified at this stage. If the patient tells their ordinary family doctor that they want an assisted death, the doctor is obliged to either explain how it works or to pass them on to someone who'll do it, which is probably what will happen, by the way, I think, Mr. Speaker. The likelihood is that we would see this new branch of medicine spring up, like the medics I met in Canada. I will in a moment. These medics I met in Canada, specialists in assisted death, who personally kill hundreds of patients a year in their special clinics. And if honourable members have a difficulty with the language, then I wonder what they're doing here. This is what we are talking about, and I met doctors for whom this is their profession and their job, which they're proud to do. Why don't I give way to that gentleman now?
I'm very grateful for the honourable member for giving way. I just want to be very clear. Medical practitioner is a synonym for doctor. It is not for nurse or pharmacist or dentist or any other practitioner. The practice of medicine, being a doctor is to be a practitioner of medicine. I think we need to be very, very clear on this. There's lots of law and regulation, and I believe that what the honourable member said is incorrect. Yeah.
Well, what it actually says is that the doctor means a registered medical practitioner who has such training qualifications and experience as the Secretary of State may specify by regulations. So obviously they are some sort of regulated medic. I recognise that. They're not necessarily a doctor. We will find out. But I recognise they're going to have professional qualifications. It's just not clear what those are going to be, because this is something that isn't in the bill. So, now, going back to this conversation that give way to the Honourable Gentleman.
Thank the Honourable Gentleman and commend him for the way in which he is engaging in this discussion in the same spirit as the Honourable Lady from Spen Valley. We often hear that one of the safeguards associated with this bill is that there are medical practitioners involved and that somebody requires a diagnosis of 6 months or less with a terminal illness. But does he accept that medicine is not an exact science? It is the science of uncertainty blended with the art of probability. That there is no exactitude in this, and no court will second guess medical opinion, though simply look a process.
I agree with the Honourable Gentleman, and he's absolutely right, and I'm afraid the definition of terminal illness, which I'll come to, is in a sense the essential flaw in this bill, but I'll come on to that. Going back to this conversation that the patient has with the medical practitioner, the crucial thing is that the conversation doesn't need to be started by the patient, according to this bill. It can be started by the medic, by any medic, perhaps in hospital, who can make the suggestion of an assisted death to a patient who's never raised the issue themselves, whose family haven't suggested it, whose own doctor doesn't think it's the right thing to do. And so the idea is planted. And then for whatever reason, and by the way, there's no need ever to give a reason, the patient says they want to proceed with the assisted death. And so they sign a declaration, or rather somebody else can sign it for them, any professional, someone they don't know, maybe a new medical practitioner. Anyway, a total stranger can do all the paperwork on their behalf. That's what the section about the proxy entails. And then these two medical practitioners do their assessment. Happy to give way.
Very grateful to the Honourable Member. I'm very grateful to the Honourable Member for giving way. I would urge the Honourable Member to check the wording of the bill, because actually, if somebody signs as a proxy, they have to know the individual for 2 years, and they are simply signing to say that they agree with the patient who wishes to go forward with the assisted dying.
No time to check the bill, but my memory is that it says someone who knows the patient for 2 years, or someone of good standing in the community, which is some sort of professional who's not known to them at all. Anyway, someone could quickly check the bill, but my understanding is it could be a total stranger to them. So we move on to the assessment, which these two practitioners do. Good work.
Isn't the matter very clear? Clause 15, subsection 5. In this section, proxy means a person who has known the person making the declaration personally for at least 2 years, or a person who is of good standing in the community. So there is no protection, such as pretended by the supporters of this bill.
Yeah, well done, Daniel.
Commissioner. Right, so the assessments have to determine whether the patient is terminally ill, whether they have mental capacity to make the decision, and then whether they've been coerced or pressured into this, into the decision. So let's look at terminally ill. As I said, this, in many ways the whole question turns on this. I'm afraid this is a term of great elasticity, almost to the point of meaninglessness. It is well known, as the Honourable Gentleman said earlier, that it is impossible for doctors to predict with any accuracy that somebody will die within 6 months. It is a purely subjective judgment made in this case by a doctor whose job is approving assisted death. They simply have to determine for themselves that not that it's reasonably certain that death will occur, but it can be reasonably expected. So basically, it's possible.
I'm grateful to my honourable friend for giving way. The thrust of the bill, as I understand it, is to ease suffering and pain with a patient who has a diagnosis who is going to die of the condition which has been diagnosed. But that right could only be exercised within a 6 month period. The pain could be a lot longer than that, the discomfort could be a lot longer than that. Has he heard, because I haven't, what is the importance of 6 months? Why not 8? Why not 10? Why not 12? And what would stop people challenging it on the grounds of the dam has been breached, the 6 months is entirely arbitrary, and therefore it could and indeed should be extended by negative resolution of a statutory instrument?
Yeah. My honourable friend makes absolutely the right point, and I'm afraid to say that is absolutely the case. There, it is completely arbitrary, the 6 months cut-off. It's impossible to determine. It's a line in the sand. And of course it could be challenged, as so much of this bill could be challenged on human rights grounds, because every one of the safeguards that has been introduced by the Honourable Lady is in fact, in practice, will be a barrier, a discrimination against the new human right that has been awarded to one group that should of course be awarded to all if it's being conceded in this way. Give way.
I thank the Honourable Gentleman for giving way. Earlier this week, myself and other colleagues met with two eminent doctors who were former presidents of the Association of Palliative Medicine, and they raised that some of their serious concerns about this bill are the fact that the doctor or medical practitioner who makes the assessment need never have met the person they are assessing or been involved in their care at all. I wonder what the Honourable Gentleman makes of that.
Lady, she makes a very important point. It's why, I'm not going to get into the question of public opinion, the polling, because it's so contested, but there is a very clear evidence that the doctors who work with the dying and the palliative care professionals are in a great majority opposed to a change in the law, both because they see the damage that it will do to the palliative care profession and services, but also because of the danger that they see for vulnerable patients. So I'm grateful to her point. Why don't I give way? Yes.
I thank him for giving way, and I appreciate that he talks to us as a medical professional, and we need to listen to his views. But isn't it true that any medical assessment is an approximation, something that you cannot say for certain? And isn't it therefore true that for this decision too, we cannot be 100% certain, but that is a way of life, and we cannot make 100% good legislation, because at some point we have to make a decision on balance whether something has merit or not. And for that reason, we should vote for this legislation.
For the Honourable Lady, especially for promoting me to the status of a doctor.
Yeah.
I'm actually a charity worker and a political hack by background. But she's good of her to credit me with those with these skills. Maybe I should set myself up as a medical practitioner.
Yes.
But I'm grateful to her points, and of course she's absolutely right. There are difficult judgments that had to be made by medics and indeed judges all the time. I think this is a very dangerous one to give them that power to do. It'd be very inappropriate. Now, the whole question about the 6 month cut-off is very important. Acknowledge all the points that have been made, but the fact is there's another problem with this definition about terminal illness. The fact is that almost anybody with a serious illness or disability could fit this definition. And I recognise that these are not the cases that the Honourable Lady has in mind for this bill. Of course they're not, but that's the problem with the bill. Because all you need to do to qualify for an assisted death, for the definition of terminal illness under this bill, is to refuse treatment, like insulin if you're diabetic. Or in the case of eating disorders, and I bring in my honourable lady and I've worked on the honourable lady and I've worked on this topic together. In the case of eating disorders, you just need to refuse food, and the evidence is in jurisdictions around the world and our own jurisprudence that that would be enough to qualify you for an assisted death.
Does he accept that every day in the NHS patients refuse treatment and indeed food, and that there's currently oversight legally around coercion, around other things in that? And wouldn't, by bringing this legislation in, we'd actually strengthen protections around those areas?
Yeah.
I'm perplexed by this argument. The suggestion that there may be coercion, of course there will be, and abuse and all sorts of injustice that go on in the current system does not mean to strike me as an argument for regulating and licensing assisted suicide. Yeah. So if there is a concerns that we have about practice in the NHS, let's deal with that. Let's not license suicide, which, by the way, again, evidence from around the world shows increases suicide in the general population. So suicide is contagious, and Oregon, which is often pointed to as an example in this debate, or in suicide outside assisted suicide laws rose by a third since assisted suicide was legalised. So there's enormous contagious effects if we were to regulate and license it in this way. Good way.
The Honourable Member for giving way, and he's making an excellent case for the bill to pass today. Because what you're actually doing, sir, is saying that there are specifics that need debate, analysis, discussion in great detail in committee. That's the whole point of it. And if it's not done with properly in committee, if it's not done within committee, then it won't pass the third reading. Your suggestion is, because you don't like specifics, that actually we can't discuss it in any form of detail.
I'm sure the Honourable Lady is delighted to have the support of the Honourable Gentleman with his bill, with the bill, and I'm afraid to say I refer him to the point that I was making. This is the inappropriate process. My Honourable Friend wants to intervene.
I'm very grateful to my Honourable Friend, who's making a superb speech, as I expected him to do. And on this issue of process, I say to the Honourable Gentleman from Boston and Skegness, my constituency neighbour, when I introduced bills to this House, very serious bills, he will know that those bills, and I think of one in particular, the Investigative Powers Bill, which has become an act, three independent reports preceded it, three letters of scrutiny of both Houses of Parliament across the House, before we went into committee. The point is that process should take place before we consider it here, a second reading, not after.
I'm very grateful. Right, what I'll do now is I'm just going to get to the run through the end of the process before I take any further interventions. So I explained that pretty much anybody with a serious illness or disability could work out how to qualify for this bill, for an assisted death under this bill. And if members think that it's far-fetched, that's what happens everywhere else, that assisted suicide is legal, including in Oregon.
Catherine Nettles, point of order.
He's using the incorrect language. It's not suicide. That's offensive. Please correct your language, Mr.
That's not a point for it, Danny.
I'm grateful for I'm afraid to say, and I'm sorry if offence is given. The fact is that the value of actually having a bill in black and white is that we do need to see what the law really is. And what this bill would do, it would amend the Suicide Act of 1961. It will allow people to assist with a suicide for the first time. So I'm afraid that is, I mean, I respect the Honourable Lady's concerns there, but I'm afraid we do have to use the proper language here. So, just quickly on this point about the broad scope. If you think that people with anorexia or other conditions that we would not regard as terminal couldn't happen here, consider the young people in the UK today who are given a diagnosis of terminal anorexia and put on a palliative care pathway, essentially assigned to death. And of course these are extreme cases, Mr. Speaker, but there are a lot, I'm not going to give way again. There are a lot of these cases, I'm afraid, and I mention them to show how wide open this bill is.
Can I just say to Honourable Lady, please keep a little calmer. You've intervened twice already. We have lots of other people in this House who also need to be heard. Danny Crew.
And I think particularly of disabled people, Mr. Speaker, many of whom require constant treatment to stay alive, all immediately and by definition eligible under the terms of this bill for a state-sponsored death. And I refer members to the Equality and Human Rights Commission, which made the point that the definition and the line between disability and terminal illness is a very blurred one, which is why the title of this bill is in fact so dangerous. Now, I'm going to just make a little more progress. The second question that the medical practitioners have to answer is about mental capacity. And here again is a great vagueness. How do you judge if someone is in their right mind when they're asking for help to kill themselves? The bill says the definition of capacity is based on the Mental Capacity Act 2005. But that act is deliberately expansive. It explicitly assumes capacity in the patient. So having acute depression is no bar to being judged to have capacity under the act. Being suicidal is no bar under the act. So the capacity test is no bar at all. And then finally, this question around coercion. Is the patient asking for an assisted death because of pressure from someone else? And there are two glaring problems here. The first is that the process doesn't even attempt to answer the question properly. There's no investigation, no requirement for the medics to interview the friends and family, no need for a psychiatrist or the family doctor to be consulted. The medics just need to satisfy themselves, who knows how, that to the best of their knowledge, the person has not been pressured. But the second problem with this coercion test is that it focuses only on one type of coercion, the less likely type. The bigger danger isn't other people pressuring you to do this, it's you pressuring yourself, and honourable members have made this point. Yeah. The bill has nothing to say to that. Internal pressure is absolutely fine. If you feel worthless or a burden to others, or if the NHS won't offer you the treatment you need, or if the local authority won't make the adjustment to your home that you need, or if you have to wait too long for a hospital appointment, if you want to die because you think the system has failed you, that's absolutely fine.
I'm on a friend on that, just on that point.
I'm going to just move on a little longer. I'll get to the end. Right, so that's the medical stage. I'll just jump straight to the judicial stage. The medical practitioners sign it off, and the judge has to confirm all these same tests as well. And, of course, many eminent judges have made the point that this would overwhelm the family courts if this test was applied properly. But it won't be, because the bill assumes that judges will fulfil this sort of new inquisitorial role, actually look into cases as investigators, which is entirely unknown in the English common law. But it won't require any actual investigation. There's no requirement for the judge to even meet the applicant. They simply have to have a phone call, or maybe it'll be an email, from one of these medics. That's it. That's their inquiry. And on that basis, they must decide if it is more likely or not that there's been external pressure. So the judge approves it, they're required to approve it unless they can find evidence of external coercion. And so we go to the final act, as the bill says, which is when a junior colleague, as a medical practitioner, oversees your death by pills or a lethal injection. And here's the last thing that the bill does or doesn't do. There is no requirement at any stage of this process, the medical or the judicial stage, for anyone to tell the patient's next of kin or their wider family or even their GP what is happening. That the NHS and the judicial system are working in secret to bring about the death of their loved one, maybe their father or their daughter. Now, I say again, these aren't the cases the bill was designed for, but they are directly in scope, and it's going to take more than a tweak in committee to get them out. Now, is this what is meant by having choice at the end of life? Now, let's talk about choice. I'm often accused of wanting to impose my view on others. People say, if you don't approve of assisted death, you don't have one, but don't deprive me of the choice. In fact, the evidence is that with this new option and the comparative loss of investment and innovation in palliative care, real choice narrows. There is a broader point to make about choice, which is that no man or woman is an island. And just as every person's death, even a good death, diminishes us all, so we will all be involved and affected if we make this change. The bill will not just create a new option for a few, it will leave everyone else unaffected. It will impose on every person towards the end of their life, on everyone who could be thought to be near death, and on their family, this new reality. The option of assisted suicide, the obligation to have the conversation around the bedside, in whispers in the corridor, is it time? And it will change life and death for everyone. Now, coming to the end, Mr. Speaker, I am very aware of the terrible plight of people begging us for this new law. I think we can do better for them than they fear. But we also need to think in real human terms what the effect would be on the choices of other people. And I don't mean the people who are used to getting their way. I'm talking about the people who lack agency, the people who know what it is to be excluded from power, have decisions made for them by bigwigs in distant offices speaking a language they don't understand. The sort of people the Honourable Lady and I both know from our previous charity work, and who we all know from our constituency work. Not the ones who write to us campaigning for a change in the law, but the people who come to our surgeries with their lives in tatters, or who the police or social workers tell us about, the people with complex needs. What are the safeguards for them? And I'll tell you, we are the safeguard. This place, this parliament, you and me, we are the people who protect the most vulnerable in society from harm, and yet we stand on the brink of abandoning that role. The Rubicon was a very small stream, Mr. Speaker, but on the other side lies a very different world, a worse world with a very different idea of human value. The idea that our individual worth lies in our utility, valuable only for so long as we are useful, not a burden, not a cost, not making a mess. Let's not be the Parliament that authorises that idea. And I mentioned at the start the voices of those we cannot hear, frail and elderly and the disabled. And since we are surrounded by such a cloud of witnesses, let us do better than this bill. Let today not be a vote for despair, but the start of a proper debate about dying well, in which we have a better idea than a state suicide service, in which we remember that we have intrinsic value, that real choice and autonomy means having access to the best care possible and the fullest control over what happens to you while you live, that true dignity consists in being cared for to the end. Thank you.
Can I just remind the House that we want to try and aim up to 8 minutes? Can I have Mother of the House, Diane Abbott?
I should like to congratulate the members of SPEC for bringing forward this bill, which has been the occasion of a very important national conversation. But I would recall to the House that in 1969, Parliament voted to abolish the death penalty for murder. Public opinion was actually against this, but MPs believed on a point of principle that the state should not be involved in taking a life. It was a good principle in 1969, and it remains a good principle today. I am not against legalising assisted dying in any circumstance, but I have many reservations about this bill, and in particular, I do not believe that the safeguards are sufficient. They are supposed to be the strongest in the world because of the involvement of a High Court judge. But the divisional courts have said the intervention of a court would simply interpose an expensive and time-consuming forensic procedure. And Sir James Munby, the former president of the Family Division of the High Court, has said recently, only those who believe implicitly in judicial omniscience and infallibility, and he adds that he does not, can possibly have any confidence in the efficacy of what is proposed. Is a judge supposed to second-guess doctors? Will the judge make a decision on the basis of paperwork? Or will there be a hearing in open court? And where will be the capacity in the criminal justice system to deal with all this? So far from being a genuine safeguard, the involvement of a judge could just be a rubber stamp.
Well, my learned friend, in more than two-thirds of our care proceedings involving the most vulnerable children in our society, they cannot complete those care proceedings within 6 months. Yeah. Does my learned friend agree that there is a real concern that this safeguard is not deliverable or risks being the rubber stamp that I know that my learned friend doesn't want it to be?
I entirely agree with my honourable friend. Robust safeguards for the sick and dying are absolutely vital to protect them from predatory relatives, to protect them from the state, but above all, to protect them from themselves. There will be those who say to themselves they don't want to be a burden. And I can imagine myself saying that in particular circumstances. Others will worry that assets they had hoped to leave for their grandchildren are being eroded by the cost of care. And there will even be a handful who will think they should not be taking up a hospital bed. We are told...
I'm very grateful to the Honourable Lady for giving way, and she makes her case powerfully, but can I ask her to comment on the current situation, whereby people ask themselves the questions she has just asked today. What safeguards are there for those people? What inquiry is made before those people pass away and often take the most drastic and horrific action to do so?
But if this House passes this legislation, the issues that I have raised will become even more foremost in people's minds. We are told that there is no evidence of coercion in jurisdictions where assisted suicide is possible. But people do not generally write letters to sick relatives urging them to consider assisted suicide and then put the letter on file. And coercion in the family context can be about not what you say, but about what you don't say. The long, meaningful pause. Yes, of course.
Giving way. As a medical professional and surrounded by even more senior medical professionals, we can all say we all miss things when there's tangibles in front of us. The shadow on x-rays, the markers and blood tests. We miss things as professionals when we can actually see them. What evidence will we have, or what security will we have of picking up things that we can't see, like coercion?
That is the point. Coercion is something that you will have no material evidence of and that you cannot see. People keep saying that this bill can't be amended. Of course, any future government could bring in new clauses. And we can see what happened in Canada, which introduced assisted dying in 2016 for adults with terminal illnesses. In 2021, it was extended to people with no terminal illness and the disabled. And in March 2027, anyone with a serious mental health problem will also be eligible. The House should remember that no single organisation representing the disabled supports this bill.
Would the Honourable Lady give way? Thank you. On that point, my daughter Maria lived her life with severe disabilities and health conditions, and since her birth, we were told many times that she might have only 6 months to live. She lived for 27 years. Crucially, Maria was non-verbal. And I am filled with dread and fear for those other people like Maria who are non-verbal and don't have that capacity, and what might happen to others like Maria if they aren't loved and cared for and have somebody speaking out for them.
I have heard so many stories like that. This arbitrary cut off of 6 months, it doesn't necessarily meet with the reality of sick people.
Right, Honourable Lady, for giving way, and I think the case of Maria and others is one that should give us all pause. But does the Right Honourable Lady agree with me? Two-thirds of the Cabinet, apparently in principle, support this measure. We should reject it today, but we should, as a House, commit not to go another 10 years of ignoring this topic, but to come forward in a considered way and ensure that it is looked at properly, and we do everything possible to have a system which is more robust, more caring, and ensures good outcomes for people like Maria.
Still say that we must try and keep to the time limit. Dinah.
I agree with the Honourable Gentleman. As I said right at the beginning, I am not against assisted dying in any circumstances. If this bill passes, we will have the NHS as a fully funded, 100% suicide service, but palliative care will only be funded at 30% at best. The former member for Dunfermline East, Gordon Brown, has said recently, we need to show we can do better at assisted living before deciding whether to legislate on ways to die. I represent very many vulnerable people in marginalised communities. I cannot vote for a bill where I have doubts about whether they will be protected. We can come back, we can have a commission, we can craft a better bill, but I will not be voting for this bill this morning. Yeah.